Today in Studio 360, we hear from a couple of apples who didn't fall too far from their respective trees. Before her movie stardom, Kate Winslet grew up in a household of struggling actors.
My parents really did not have any money. I mean, we lived in a house that, you know, the electricity, you had to put money into a meter to make it work.
But the hard times did not discourage her from going into the family business.
I saw people doing it for all the right reasons, and that was why I wanted to do it. You were meant
for me. Later, a great soul singer who died young lives on through his daughter.
I knew I wanted to cover one of my dad's tunes for this record because the record is about my beginnings as a musician, as an artist.
Layla Hathaway sings the songs of Donny Hathaway. And we'll take a look at the new book by the novelist Newt Gingrich. I'm Kurt Anderson. All that and more is ahead today in Studio 360, right after this.
You're listening to the podcast of Studio 360 from Public Radio International and WNYC, where each week Kurt Anderson brings you great stories and conversation about creativity, pop culture, and the arts. We have a great website, too. Visit studio360.org to find out more.
Studio 360 is supported by Scion. Scion, making vehicles for today's connected youth and offering over 150 accessories to choose from. Learn more at scion.com. Scion, what moves you?
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. Today on the show, I'll talk to the actress Kate Winslet. And one of our producers will go for a ride on the most dangerous art exhibit in New York.
She's coming down.
Wow. Oh, that was so great.
But first, every Republican presidential campaign this time seems to be doubling as a book tour, which is sort of unavoidable for Newt Gingrich since he publishes books at a rate of 2 a year. And the improbable new front runner in the race is the only one selling a novel. The Battle of the Crater is Gingrich's ninth work of fiction, all written with a co-author. This one fictionalizes a real 1864 Civil War battle that was a victory for the Confederates. The Montana-based novelist Walter Kern has just finished the book. Hi there.
Hey there, Kurt.
Before we talk about the merits of the book, what's the basic story here?
Well, the Battle of Crater is about a great assembly of black troops who fight a critical battle in Northern Virginia, which, you know, it's hoped will turn the tide of the war. And we follow them very closely as they get ready. And then we watch this poignant and bloody battle in which they are horribly defeated, but somehow spiritually ennobled.
Was it good? Was it gripping? Did it work as fiction?
You know, it moves very crisply. The sentences are clean, and it's a Hollywood battle in some ways. It's got a huge set piece in which the Union troops build tunnels and try to create a huge explosion that will give them a entry point.
The history is interesting in how Gingrich and his co-author shaded the facts of that battle for whatever purposes. There's a review of it by an historian in The Atlantic who is, in fact, a specialist in this battle and says it's odd that he left out the massacre and murder of all these black Union soldier prisoners in the aftermath, given that his hero, right, is a black sergeant?
Yeah, he's a major, actually. Garland White of the USCT, the United States Colored Troops, I believe that stands for. He leads his men on a doomed and valiant mission, and you wouldn't know from inside the novel what happens historically. You are led to assume that you're reading history and accurate history, but apparently that's not the case. Most of these black troops were killed after the battle proper was over in a sort of vengeful show of force by the Confederacy, meant to, it seems, put the black troops in their place and warn them that there would be no quarter given. I read a review of the book this morning. The thesis was that Newt was playing politics. This was a calculated attempt to suppress the truth about Confederate atrocities so as to appeal to, you know, a certain cut of Southern white voters. That's certainly possible. It may even be likely.
This is not a counterfactual fiction, other than its slightly peculiar shaping of this big central fact. It's the battle as it happened.
It might be counter-meaningful.
It's not a counterfactual, which is the kind of novel that Newt Gingrich and his fiction novel co-author have specialized in, including one called 1945, in which the U.S. does not declare war against Germany and the Nazis are victorious throughout Europe. And I got to thinking about counterfactual fiction and the way in which running for president, especially if you're Newt Gingrich, involves telling a counterfactual history of your own life, right?
Well, you know, counterfactuality, the soul of politics, really. I mean, whoever got elected telling the truth either about themselves or about the situation. Some have, but it seems rarer and rarer. There's a kind of grandiosity to historical fiction. You know, you're appropriating real events, often terrible events when you're writing about war, and using them to make points. And instead of dealing with the solemnity and the mystery of the past, you're trying to make it work to influence people's thinking about current issues. But in any case, the very gravitas, so to speak, of being a historical novelist, somebody who's in such intimate command of American history that they can bend it and look at it from this direction and from that one, I think probably serves Newt's greater attempt to seem thoughtful and above the usual run of candidates.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, the embrace of Herman Cain by so many Republicans over the last few months proved in a real way that, look, you may call us racist. We're not. We love this black guy. Similarly, the Republicans are often these days accused of being anti-intellectual. Here, their new favorite is an intellectual and a novelist to boot. And one of the reasons that he's rising is not because he's written novels, but the fact that he's a writer is part of his kind of quirky idiosyncrasy as opposed to, say, Mitt Romney.
Well, you know, Newt's favorite move of the last couple of weeks is challenging everyone to Lincoln Douglas style debates. He seems confident he's going to outshine them all, you know, verbally and in terms of his command of facts, you know, present, past, and future, maybe. And so I look at this book, and then I look at the kind of books that Barack has published, more interior, meditative works on his personal identity. And I think that might predict the tone of a campaign that we'd see later, you know, in which Newt sort of points to the great sweep and panorama of American history and, you know, suggests that Barack is maybe too self-involved.
You heard it here first. Walter Kern, thank you very much.
Okie doke. Thanks, Kurt.
Walter Kern is the author of Up in the Air, among other novels. You can hear another conversation I had about Newt Gingrich's new novel with an historian whose specialty is the very battle Gingrich writes about. That's online at studio360.org.
An apple for the teacher. That seems the thing to do.
Last week on the show, we mentioned that we're moving forward with Studio 360's next big redesign project, school teachers. Turns out a lot of teachers hate the treacly old-fashioned visual imagery that gets dumped on them. ABCs, 1-2-3s, chalkboards, rulers, apples. And we love the name teachers have for this iconography. Apple Crapple.
I've never seen an actual apple come from a student.
When it comes to the apple, unfortunately, their Red Delicious is always used, and personally, I cannot stand Red Delicious.
And apples, I think, are funny because apples are for the teacher's desk, and I never sit down at my desk, so.
Can you imagine one of your kids actually coming in with an apple?
Before we engaged our professional design team, we wanted to get a better idea from teachers how they'd like to be rebranded for the 21st century.
Maybe not having an actual apple as a piece of fruit in the classroom, but we see a lot of apples in terms of iPads and iPods and Macs and computers and technology, and I think that's something that needs to come across in our imagery.
Coffee. If you want a food product, coffee.
I guess traditional images that do kind of bother me are rulers, mostly because parents still and grandparents have stories about, you know, being whacked with rulers. It just blows my mind that things like that used to happen.
Empty pockets. You know, because that's true. I mean, whether it's the teacher or really even the school district, especially school districts, you know, there isn't enough money to go around, so we can't afford these things. You know, maybe it's a schoolhouse with empty pockets.
A person with like multiple hats. You know, we are expected to be the caretaker, the parent, the doctor, the nurse, the lawyer, the school psychologist.
It's ideas. We teach ideas, and how do we represent ideas? My best guess, a question mark.
We heard from teachers in Seattle, Minneapolis, and New York City. And we want to keep hearing from all of you teachers out there about our redesign and rebranding project. Go to studio360.org to give us your ideas. Special thanks to KUOW's Phyllis Fletcher and Minnesota Public Radio's Carolina Ostrayin. Coming up, the actress Kate Winslet on her latest extraordinarily realistic and moving performance.
That was my second on-screen vomit, actually.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah, my
You're
first.
A veteran.
No, but this was a proper throw-up. It was so much fun. I got very involved with the consistency of the vomit.
Kate Winslet, charming and funny even when she's being gross. That's ahead in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Don't go away.
Support for Studio 360 is provided by Live from Lincoln Center, broadcasting New York City Ballet's The Nutcracker on Wednesday, December 14th at 8. Broadcast times are available through local PBS listings. Studio 360 is supported by Scion. Scion, making vehicles for today's connected youth and offering over 150 accessories to choose from. Learn more at scion.com. Scion, what moves you?
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. When she was just 21, Kate Winslet got a pretty good part.
You jump high, jump right.
Right. Kaboom! Instant movie star. 15 years later, she's proved that wasn't a fluke. Whether playing a former Nazi prison guard or a tragically bored housewife, she makes you believe. And she can play for laughs. Winslet's new movie, Carnage, is a faithful adaptation of the hit Broadway comedy God of Carnage. It's directed by Roman Polanski and stars Winslet, Christoph Waltz, Jodie Foster, and John C. Reilly as two sets of yuppie parents trying to sort out what happened after a fight between their 11-year-old sons. The entire movie takes place in real time in one Brooklyn apartment.
You think my son is a snitch?
I don't think anything.
Well, if you don't think anything, don't say anything. Don't make insinuations.
Well, Nancy, there's no reason to lose our cool here, okay? Michael and I have gone out of our way to be fair-minded and conciliating.
Not so fair-minded.
Oh, really?
Superficially fair-minded.
Doodle, I have to go.
So go, coward.
Kate Winslet, welcome to Studio 360.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
So even though the parents are ostensibly meeting about the kids, the movie is really all about the adults.
It's about flinging a lot of mud at each other and each other's marriages. And the cracks within each of these marriages are somewhat revealed, shall we say. And not only revealed, but really explored and thrown around a room. Throw in a little apple and pear cobbler and some whiskey in the middle of the afternoon, and it adds for some pretty interesting fireworks, shall we say.
But we should stipulate that, all that said, it's not Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf. It's a comedy.
It's a comedy. It is very much a comedy.
Let's get out of here, Alan. These people are monsters.
Stop it, Nancy.
No. I want to drink some more. I want to get drunk off my ass. This bitch throws my bag against the ceiling. Nobody lifts a finger. I want to be blind drunk.
You're drunk enough.
How can you let her call our son a criminal? We come over here to work things out with them, and they insult us, they browbeat us, they lecture us about being good citizens of the planet. I am glad our son kicked the shit out of your son, and I wipe my ass with your human rights.
Wow. get a couple drinks in her, and bam! Her true self comes out. What happened to that gracious, demure woman with the soft eyes?
That is Kate Winslet and John C. Reilly in Carnage.
Yes, it's a satire, and we really did have an extraordinary time making this film. You know, it is set in New York, it's set in Brooklyn, and was directed by Roman Polanski. So what we did was we rehearsed the entire piece very much like a play, and I haven't done theatre for a really long time, not since I was 18, so it really,
took
me right back there, and Jodie's never done theatre.
That's Jodie Foster, who plays the other mother.
That's right, Jodie Foster, exactly, and so for her, this really was a very, very different experience, and we had 2 weeks of rehearsal, and we all had asked Roman prior to day one, you know, would you like us to learn this like a play, you know, should we learn the entire script? Then no, we don't need to do that, no. So we thought, okay, fine. And at the end of the first week, it was Friday afternoon, and Roman said, okay, this weekend you'll learn it, and we'll see you on Monday. And of course we all went to sort of a very, very white shade of white, and we said, but hang on, Roman, we asked you if you wanted us to learn this, you know, before we started. He said, yes, I know, I changed my mind. So we went home and learnt it over the weekend and came back.
Oh, Roman,
you card, you. And we came back in on Monday morning having learnt it. And then we really did just go through it like a juggernaut and staged it, rehearsed it. And then we started filming at the beginning. And we shot in story order, in exact story order. Yeah, from beginning to end. We just worked through it like a play and filmed it along the way.
In addition to doing an American accent beautifully and, of course, acting wonderfully, you drunk really well. Drunkenness is a very hard thing not to overdo.
What are you suggesting?
I'm not suggesting anything, except had you done that before?
What, got drunk?
No, professionally simulated drunkenness.
I have actually, yeah. I did a film called Holy Smoke, which was directed by Jane Campion with Harvey Keitel a long time ago. Yeah, and I had a couple of scenes in that actually where I had to be drunk, but one had to be fairly significantly drunk. And I did actually have a couple of drinks to loosen myself up before a take, and then vowed I would never, ever, ever resort to that tactic again.
You do, however, have to, at one point, spectacularly vomit. Was that a first for you?
That was my second on-screen vomit, actually.
Really? Okay.
Yeah,
my first being, but
only fairly recently in Mildred Pierce, I had to do a vomit.
Right.
No, but this was a proper throw-up. It was just so much fun. I got very involved with the consistency of the vomit, I have to say.
Well, I was going to ask, and it's a perverse interest of mine, but how exactly does that work? Is there like a bag that you hold in your cheek, or how does it exactly happen?
Well, we did, in truth, because it is such a violent vomit, we did several versions of it. Obviously, you know, that amount of vomit could not be held in anyone's mouth. So we did versions where I was holding as much in my mouth as I could, and that would be the sort of the beginning part of the take, for example. But then the actual violence of the regurgitated cobbler.
That's a cut.
That was a cut. And yeah, there was a rig and a little bit of CGI also that went on to.
Really? There's CGI vomiting?
Oh, very much
film.
So. Oh, believe me, there are photographs around somewhere or other taken by our stills photographer of me in a full blue suit against a blue screen. With a full rig, you know, it was very much a Gollum scenario.
Who knew?
No, I really did look a little bit like I was one of those kind of, you know, those stop, what do you call it? The
motion capture. No,
there you go. Yeah. I look like a little bit of a motion capture person, minus the tennis balls.
Well, it is interesting that he made the choice, and obviously going into it, you were aware of that he made the choice to not attempt, as movies based on plays sometimes do, to open it up and have long walks or car accidents. It's all in this apartment for an hour and a half.
That's right. It's all in one room. You're right.
Did that give
you
any pause going into it?
No, none whatsoever. I mean, look, when Roman Polanski sends you a script and says, will you play this part? The word no just doesn't come into it.
Speaking of saying yes instantly when Roman Polanski calls and offers you a good role, did you think also, as I would have, interesting, Roman Polanski making this movie about misbehavior and accountability and moral justice, given his life? Was that interesting?
You know, it's really funny that you say that. I'm getting quite good at answering these questions about Roman now, in the sense that I actually don't really answer them at all.
Okay.
No. Here's the funny thing is that I love him so much. You know, he's really a wonderful, wonderful man. And so I automatically feel very defensive of him and protective. But the one thing I would certainly say about Roman is that, you know, yes, of course, he has had a really interesting life. And he has, you know, experienced a great many things that the majority of people do not even come close to. And one thing he has managed to do is to use his experiences to enhance his creative self. So his understanding of the human conditions, shall we say, is fairly profound and extensive in comparison to the majority of us out there. And in this piece, you know, his experiences of child rearing and marriage and his own observations of the way that other people conduct themselves in relationships, as well as his own experiences, really did make for some interesting insights, you know, which were very beneficial to all of us. And also all of us actors, we're parents too. And so, you know, we all had a different experience of a version of this type of story that we were able to bring to the table as well.
Well, you have an 11-year-old too. So have you ever been anything remotely like this with your misbehaving 11-year-old?
Oh, my beautiful, not misbehaving, angelic 11-year-old. No.
She's never hit anyone?
No, she's... her brother, let me tell you. Oh, yeah, of course.
You had parents and grandparents with theatrical careers, so you come by this congenitally. But when you were looking at those lives, those hard scrabble actor lives, did that shape your decision? Oh, I want to do that when you were a kid.
Well, it's funny because I sort of grew up in a family where everybody seemed to be doing it. I mean, you know, my father was an actor. That's absolutely true. And my mother, she actually isn't an actress and never had aspirations to be one. But her parents were both actors.
Uh-huh.
They ran a repertory theatre company in Reading, the town that I grew up in and also where my family still live and grew up. And the theatre was in the back garden. So literally the back garden. So my mum was constantly surrounded by actors coming and going and costumes and sets being built in the you know, front room. And that was how she met my father. He was friends with her brothers who were acting. So I sort of grew up a little bit around that.
So did you feel as though you were sort of, it was natural that you'd go into the family business?
I just kind of felt like I was already doing it, really, I suppose, just always. But I certainly never thought about films, and we didn't get a television until I was about 10 and a VCR when I was 14.
Really?
No. And
this is in the 1980s when you're, or 90s.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, people seem not to believe me when I say this because I've always been fairly well spoken. But my parents really did not have any money. I mean, we lived in a house that, you know, the electricity, you had to put money into a meter to make it work. And if the meter ran out and you didn't have the right coins, well, we'd live in darkness until someone had, you know, the 50 pence coin to put in the meter to make the electricity work again. I mean, that honestly is how I grew up. So I never thought about films. I just saw these people being so fulfilled through having such a wonderful time and feeling so happy doing this creative and glorious thing for a living, and actually not even really for a living because they weren't making any money from it. So I suppose my introduction to that world was really, really fortunate because I saw people doing it for all the right reasons.
Yeah.
And that was why I wanted to do it.
Back in 2005 on Ricky Gervais's HBO show Extras, you very wonderfully played yourself playing a nun in a Holocaust movie. I want to play a clip of that performance.
I'd just like to say, I think, you know, you doing this is so commendable, you know, using your profile to keep the message alive about the Holocaust.
God, I'm not doing it for that. I mean, I don't think we really need another film about the Holocaust, do we? It's like, how many have there been? You know, we get it. It was grim. Move on. No, I'm doing it because I've noticed that if you do a film about the Holocaust, guaranteed an Oscar. I've been nominated 4 times. Never won. And the whole world is going, why hasn't Winslet won one?
Death, yeah.
That's it. That's why I'm doing it. Schindler's Bloody List. The Pianist. Oscars coming out of their arse.
And then, 4 years later, Kate Winslet goes on to win an Oscar for her performance in The Reader, which is pretty much a Holocaust movie.
Oh, my God. It is so funny. Oh, God. It's so funny. I haven't heard that for a long time.
It was great.
Oh, God. It's so hilarious, isn't it? Hysterical. You know, but that's, it's really important for actors to send themselves up, don't you think?
Yeah.
And especially if you are successful or in the public eye, you know, you just, like, we can't take ourselves seriously. We mustn't ever, ever do that.
So when you climb up on that stage to get the Oscar for The Reader, did you think, oh, gosh?
Honestly, someone said to me earlier that day during of the Oscar ceremony, you know, my God, you know, can you imagine the quotes in the British press, you know, when everyone remembers the Ricky Gervais thing and I'm sure I'm going to be hearing from Ricky kind of thing, you know. And sure enough, of course, I did. You know, I got a text message later that night having won, you know, from Gervais saying, oi, Winslet, told you so, you know.
There you go.
Very, very funny.
Kate Winslet, thank you very, very much. It was a pleasure talking to you.
You too, thank you.
Kate Winslet's latest movie is Carnage. It opens around the country on December 16th. When you go to an art museum, there is a certain etiquette. Don't touch the art, don't stand too close, and by the way, hands off the art. Right now, at the New Museum in New York, there's a huge exhibit that breaks all those rules. There are pieces in this show that you can climb, ride on, stick your head into, smell, even eat. It's the work of an artist who's taken an unorthodox path to the art world, and it shows. Studio 360's Sarah Lilly volunteered to submit.
I'm in an elevator on my way up to the top floor of the New Museum.
Okay, here we are on the fourth floor.
Sometimes it feels to me like it's like somebody's tickling my brain, you know, when I'm hearing birdsong, especially when it's live.
That's Karsten Höller. He's a 50-year-old Belgian guy who lives in Sweden, and this is his show. I found myself standing under a giant hanging mobile with seven canary cages. Those little birds you hear are real, and they're quite vocal.
I knew always that I had an interest both in art and in science. I'm very fond of birds, and I thought if I study biology, I'm kind of lost because I'm going to end up as a ornithologist in some kind of station somewhere, you know, studying birds and becoming a real nerd. So I thought I better don't do that.
Höller wanted to be a bit more practical, so he chose to study agricultural science.
And I just thought, you know, you can always become an artist, but you cannot always become a scientist. There are very few autodidactic scientists. And also you need access to a laboratory with all its equipment, otherwise you just can't do it at home on your kitchen table. So I studied agricultural science and then specialized in insect communication through smells. I did the whole thing and I did a PhD. I was really a hardcore scientist for a while.
But then, gradually, his interest in art began to crowd in. And he found that he just couldn't ignore it.
You know, I never studied anything about art. So I had to, you know, teach myself, see as many exhibitions as I could. But in 93, I stopped with the science.
Kind of. I mean, looking around this exhibit, I'm not so sure about that. In addition to the canaries, there's also a giant fish tank. It's got three stations where you can lie on your back with your head sticking into an indentation in the outside of the glass. Your head is surrounded by fish tank, so it feels as if you're in there with them. In another part of the gallery, there are scattered life-size and very realistic animal sculptures sleeping on the floor, including a crocodile, a baby rhinoceros, a walrus. Each is made of a different neon-colored polyurethane. Oh yeah, plus real whiskers and horns.
I'm fascinated by the impossibility of understanding the animal. They seem so close, at the same time they're so distant. There's many, many different qualities of being alive. The animal is a kind of living proof for the fact that there are other ways that we don't have access to.
Höller is at least trying to simulate that access, both to the world of the animal, but also to that of the scientist.
There's something called experience corridor. So it's like five rooms, one after the other, where you can lock yourself in, almost like in a bathroom. And so you can do experiments with yourself. Two are visual, two are tactile, and one is olfactive.
I went in there and put on a pair of blacked-out goggles with little video screens inside, one for each eye. I'm suddenly looking around a forest in twilight, moving through the trees. Then, gradually, the two different screens change their directions of movement, my right eye in one direction, while my left in the opposite. It's as if all of a sudden my eyes have migrated to opposite sides of my head, like a fish or a goat. My brain quietly struggles to experience both views at the same time. It's certainly a different kind of artistic vision.
Many of my colleagues express their visions in some way, but I don't want to do that. Really, I don't have these visions that I find worthwhile to communicate through an art object, but I have an interest and also a proposition to make to, you know, not stop where we are, but just see what else there could be. And I'm pretty sure there is more than we know.
This feeling of testing a different point of view comes up a lot in Haller's pieces. On the third floor, there's a sensory deprivation tank. It's a saline pool at body temperature that people can strip down and float in, which is pretty ambitious for a museum show. On the first floor, there's another set of, not goggles, but a kind of headgear that you can borrow and walk around the show in. They're made to reverse your vision, so everything is upside down. For Haller, his work is about seeing what everything feels like.
So many of these things have to do with the idea of losing control in a specific way and just see what happens, really.
Kind of like the most famous piece in the show, the giant stainless steel slide. It's a tube that spirals from the fourth floor to the second, and it's quite speedy, like a George Jetson mail chute for people, dumping you out at the end. But, as Haller points out, even the folks too scared to ride it still experience its power by watching, by hearing, by anticipating.
How can I say this now? Like, it's neither a tool, nor environment, nor machine, but just say an object that produces a specific kind of madness, really, that comes out slightly differently in everybody. But it's impossible not to smile when you come down. And At another occasion, we've been offering $100 for everybody who would manage not to smile, but we kept the money.
Really?
Yes.
That's fantastic.
Yeah, so it's a smile machine.
It's way, way, way faster than I thought it was going to be. And this little twist right here is kind of like a little surprise. I like that at the end. I love it.
So, here's my question. Is being a scientist, you know, a professional seeker of answers, is that somehow related to what artists do?
No, I don't think there's an answer that could be found through an art object, really. And in some way, this exhibition here is very much to do with that, these things that we don't have an answer for. The experience, really, of being alive, that's one of the strangest things that we have.
I'm gonna do it.
Okay, she's coming down.
For Studio 360.
Wow! Oh, this is cool!
I'm Sarah Lilly.
Oh, that was so great.
Karsten Huller's show at the New Museum is up through January 15th in New York. You can see a slideshow of the exhibit at studio360.org. Coming up, it's that time of year again.
Hang all the mistletoe, I'm gonna get to know you better.
No, I mean a chance to remember the music of the late, great Donny Hathaway.
I would like to believe that my name is like a 30-year-long brand that my father really started and that I am carrying on.
Donny Hathaway's daughter, Layla Hathaway, is just ahead in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us.
We're caroling through the night, and this Christmas.
Studio 360 is supported by Scion. Scion, making vehicles for today's connected youth and offering over 150 accessories to choose from. Learn more at scion.com. Scion, what moves you?
This is Kurt Anderson in Studio 360. I'm more a reader of novels than short stories, but I sort of fell in love with a new collection I came across. And when I say short stories, I mean really, really short, just 420 characters apiece, including spaces. They feature Western gunslingers, couples in crisis, dogs, talking chickens. Some of them are funny, some are sad, some bracingly realistic, some very strange and haunting. Here's one of them in its entirety.
The storm came over the ridge, a rocket, dropped rain like bees, filled the corral with water and noise. I watched lightning hit the apple tree and thought, fritters, as we packed sandbags against the flood. There was nowhere to go that wasn't wet. The squall had punched a hole in the cabin roof, and the barn was knee-high in mud. We'll bury Jess later, when the river recedes, before the ground turns hard again.
That is the author, Lou Beach, reading from his book, 420 Characters. Lou is first and foremost an illustrator and collage artist whose work I've followed for years in The New Yorker, Harper's, and on the covers of dozens of CDs. He didn't start writing fiction until just a couple of years ago after he joined Facebook.
I quickly became bored with the status updates of, I had coffee with Joe and Jimmy's graduating, blah, blah, blah. So I thought I would just inject some fantasy, some fiction. I had always dreamed about being a writer when I was younger, but I gravitated towards the visual arts. That was just easier for me. But I'm an avid reader, and it was sort of a way for me to teach myself how to write, although in a scary way. It was sort of improvisational. You know, I was doing it in front of a live audience, if you will. I didn't edit them very well at all. I'd write them and throw them on there.
What about the process of doing them? Did it come easily? You said you're an avid reader, which is clear to me from reading these because they are so skillful and so tonally sophisticated. Did they come easy once you started doing this pretty much?
Yeah. Most of them are created in that limbo space between waking and dreaming. They are attached to the tail end of a dream generally, which I learned to do a long time ago as an illustrator when I couldn't, because, as a freelance illustrator, I'd have to solve a problem,
right?
How to tell the editorial story. And I would mull the thing over in my sleep and oftentimes in that limbo time in the morning. So I just gravitated back to that area and stories would come and then I'd get up and type them out.
So when you started writing these stories, Facebook had a 420 character limit. Was it tough for you to keep your stories to that strict length?
It was a very good exercise. I just got rid of a lot of junk and just went for the heart of the narrative. But that's the same thing as making art as well. You just pile a whole lot of stuff on there and you take it out till you've got the essence.
Yeah. Well, no, and economy is never a bad thing.
Well, our economy's not doing so.
That's true. But I mean economy as a goal in the arts.
Sure.
Even within these constraints, there's an incredibly wide variety of narrative going on here, and happy and funny and sad and mysterious and ugly. But and I mean that in the best sense.
Yeah.
Why don't you read one?
Okay. Well, I do think of them as sort of a Whitman sampler, so that there are the sweet cherry ones and the nougat ones and the ones with nuts. So here we go. I'm alone on deck, sharing a smoke with myself. There's no moon, but the stars are a city in the sky, and I can see for miles. A last puff, and I flick the cigarette over the rail and watch it spin in the wake, succumb. I raise my eyes and catch a dimple at the horizon, where the sea tucks itself under the sky. It's home, half a pack away.
That's lovely. I'm going to encourage you to read a couple that sort of show your more surreal and maybe magical realist side. And since they have no titles, I'm going to have to give you the page number. The one,
sure.
Page 17.
Are you my mommy? Said the little blue egg. No, dear. You are a plastic trinket full of sweets, said the brown hen. My baby is over there. And she pointed to a pink marshmallow chick being torn apart and devoured by a toddler. The hen screamed and woke up, her pillow wet with sweat, the sheets twisted around her legs. Christ, I hate that dream. She reached for a smoke.
I love everything about that. That was Lou Beach reading from his book of extremely short stories called 420 Characters. So now, Lou, I'm going to invite our listeners to try writing their own stories at 420 characters or less. Would you come back and be our guest celebrity judge?
Sure, I'd love to.
Great. Before they start it, of course, they should take a look at yours to maybe be inspired. But do you have any specific advice for how to approach this peculiar and particular form?
I wouldn't worry about the length to begin with. Just write till it feels right, and then go back and pare it down if you need to. These are to be limited to 420 characters, I'm assuming.
Absolutely. Lou Beach, thanks very much.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate it.
Lou Beach's book is called 420 Characters, and you can hear him reading more of his stories at studio360.org. And we really do want to see your 420 character stories. That's 420 characters or less, including spaces. Submit your story at our website. The winner will get a print by Lou Beach. All the details are at studio360.org, and the deadline for the contest is New Year's Eve. The singer Layla Hathaway's first record was back in 1969. She couldn't talk yet, wasn't even a year old, but that's her wailing on her father's single, The Ghetto. Did I mention that her dad was Donny Hathaway? You probably know Donny from his soul duets with Roberta Flack, like Where Is the Love and The Closer I Get to You. One of the most promising talents of his generation, Hathaway suffered from depression for much of his life and committed suicide in 1979 at age 33. Donny's daughter, Layla, has had her own career in contemporary R&B and just released her sixth solo album. But as Eddie Robinson discovered, she is still coming to terms with her burden of the past.
Layla's father was a soul music legend, and her mother was a singer too. So it's hard to believe that she originally had other aspirations.
I wanted to be a magician, and I am a magician. I used to tell my mother, I want to be a magician, and she'd say, no, baby, you want to be a musician. And I'd say, no, I want to do magic tricks. I wanted to act. I paint.
But maybe it was inevitable that the daughter would follow in her father's footsteps. Her husky alto even sounds a bit like Donny. And so in 1990, Layla put out her debut album while she was still a student at the Berklee School of Music.
Bling, bling.
Early on, Layla seemed to tiptoe around her father's legacy, but eventually she began singing on other musicians' covers of Donny Hathaway songs, with artists like Take Six, Pete Escovedo, Kirk Whalum. Then in 2008, she co-wrote a song about her father called Little Girl.
Daddy, in that big old sky, ran fast, maybe too fast sometimes, always there, always there. Right here, yeah, pain and glory on my effing dial. I say daddy in that big old sky and people think in the sky, and I really mean in his hat, because he called his hat his sky. And I think a lot of people miss that. But he used to say, I gotta get my sky. That was his hat. And I love that lyric because my dad did absolutely run fast.
Well, Donny was funny. He was hilariously funny. And believe it or not, Layla has some of that same humor.
That's Eulalia Hathaway, Layla's mom.
But I guess the main thing was when he was well, he was quite a pleasant person to be around. And as I said before, he was funny, very caring. She was basically Daddy's little girl.
Donny Hathaway was also a hugely gifted musician who suffered from serious depression. In his 20s, he was a writer, arranger, and conductor. But he couldn't quite make it big on his own and was frustrated with his career. His final solo album incorporated Latin jazz, blues, gospel, and honky-tonk. His daughter Layla thinks that music industry pressure to fit in probably contributed to his state of mind. She's felt that pressure herself.
I think that there is a pressure within the industry to compartmentalize things, particularly with soul music. And the shame is that soul music informs so much other music. As a black woman, if I make a record right now that doesn't have any rap on it, or the drum beat is not a particular pattern, then it doesn't fit on a hip-hop station. So then where does it go? It goes to maybe a smooth jazz station, or maybe it goes to the classic. I mean, there's two or three places you can go. So I think there is a pressure to commercially do what the most people would like you to do. I think as artists, sometimes we struggle because we want to do many things.
In your mind, Ms. Hathaway, why? Why do you think Donny left us the way he did?
Well, you know what, I'm from the old school of saying of what will be, but maybe it was to make room for her, who knows.
It's weird, I don't really have a lot of memory. I was 10 years old when he died. One time I played Japan in 1991 or 1992, and this man came, he was probably 50 years old, little Japanese man with a suit on, and he sat really stoically in the middle of the room, and I started singing Someday We'll All Be Free, and he, for the whole rest of the show, had all of my father's vinyl records in plastic, and each song would change and he would move a record, and he sat there and cried the whole show. Like, this dude, to come to my show and bring those records, I signed them for him and we took pictures and everything, and he never even really spoke. But that it had touched him that much from that far away in another language altogether that many years ago, it's a really fond memory for me. It is really a testament of how much my dad really, really meant to people, you know, even people that could not understand the words.
And now, for the first time in 20 years, Layla has decided to record one of her father's songs on her own album, Where It All Begins. She sings, "You Were Meant for Me." It was the last single Donny released before his death.
You were meant for me. No one else could come between this love I know. 'Cause I'll never let you go.
I knew I wanted to cover one of my dad's tunes for this record because the record is about my beginnings as a musician, as an artist, as a beginning. And that song, for me, best fit the color of the whole record.
'Cause you'll always be the one.
It seems like Layla can finally be her own person and be her father's daughter.
I would like to believe that my name is a brand that is like a 30-year-long brand that my father really started and that I am carrying on, so that when you hear that name, you don't even care what it is. Is it country record or operatic record? Is she doing show tunes? That you don't care, that you get it, period. You have to have that.
And perhaps her dad's tragic life can give a deeper perspective on fame and success.
There's an aspect of my father which is lost because he was paranoid schizophrenic. So I don't think that he was sitting around really consumed with whether or not he was an iconic figure. I think he was dealing with whatever was going on inside of his head. But I do think a lot of artists, you know, we want to be iconic. We want a million people to love us. We want the Lady Gaga career. But generally speaking, we're just moving forward. We're just kind of trying to keep it moving and keep the train on the track.
For Studio 360, I'm Eddie Robinson.
Layla Hathaway's new record is called Where It All Begins. And that is it for this week's show. Thanks so much for listening, and I hope you'll listen again next time. Studio 360 is a production of WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International. Our production team includes
Vital Malad,
David Krasnow,
Michelle Siegel,
Derek John,
Jenny Lawton,
Josh Rogerson,
Alana Harper,
John Delore,
Emma Miller,
Katie Long,
Sharon Mashihi.
Our theme music is by David Van Tegum, and thanks, as always, to WNYC's Chris Bannon.
Studio 360 is supported by Scion. Scion, making vehicles for today's connected youth and offering over 150 accessories to choose from. Learn more at Scion.com. Scion, what moves you? And by Ken and Lucy Lehman, who believe that winning workplaces respect, reward, and invest in their employees. By the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art. And by the SC Group, whose charitable resources include FJC, a foundation of donor-advised funds, at fjc.org. Studio 360's series on creativity and science is supported in part by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, enhancing public understanding of science and technology in the modern world. More information is online at sloan.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.
Next time in Studio 360, computers are getting smarter and smarter, but will they ever think like us?
No machine is ever going to experience the rest of the world in the same way that a human being does.
Can computers be creative? We'll try to find out next time in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.
You've been listening to Studio 360 with Kurt Anderson from Public Radio International and WNYC. You can find out more about this episode, access our entire program archive, and leave us a comment at studio360.org.